Blog Talk Radio.
Well, here we go, ladies and gentlemen, across the airwaves. We just started out strong. We just had the Breaking It Down podcast where Dan Good, the author of Playing Through the Pain, the Ken Caminiti story. And now we follow right into this show that just keeps picking up steam each and every Tuesday. Live from Cleveland, Ohio, the American History podcast, sports, to put that frankly, hosted by my good friend, a brother, a mentor, Peter Ray, yours truly, Mark Mancini, producing in Los Angeles, 347-205-9631. This show goes by quick. Catch the archive on blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports, podcast platforms, wherever you subscribe to podcasts, powered now by Mancini Media. So as I lay the red carpet down, put the podium in its place, hand off the mic, first of all, Peter, how are you? Second of all, how can people get a hold of you? And third of all, you're bringing another legend in here, and I can't wait to hear this along with the listeners.
Hi, Mark. I'm doing well. I have a YouTube channel. It's my name, Peter J. Ray, R-E-A, and my email was there. You're absolutely right. Tonight's guest is the author of two classic baseball books. Talk about American sports history. The first, Cincinnati's Basketball Royalty, A Brief History, a look back at 15 years of Cincinnati Royals NBA basketball, 1957 to 1972. And this year he's got a book on, the title is Jerry Lucas, Mr. Ohio Basketball. Remembering his great basketball years, 1955 to 1974, the Pro Basketball Hall of Famer, Jerry Lucas. Welcome to the show, Mr. Jerry Schultz.
Oh, thanks very much for having me.
So, Jerry, first of all, do you want to give us an overall view of your book on the Cincinnati Royals?
Yeah, I can do that. I sort of fell into the project while I was looking for a book on the team, and this was maybe sometime around 2010 or something. And, you know, I'm just a sports fan. I've been watching sports since 1970, and I remember that the Royals used to play games in Cleveland, which is the area I'm from. And I just wanted to see if there was a book available on those teams because, you know, I remember the Hall of Fame players, and they had some very competitive teams. I thought it would be fun to read, you know, read about. And then I found out that there really wasn't a book just about the Royals team. And, you know, I had studied some journalism when I was in college, so I just kind of decided I would try to write it. And it was a great experience.
The I'm making my way. I have a copy. I'm up to page 150. I got some notes here. Do you want to talk about Maurice Stokes?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Stokes is an amazing figure, underrated all-time player. He was born in the Great Depression in the 1930s in segregated Pittsburgh, about as far down as a lot of people live in major cities during that time. Economically, his father worked at a steel mill, and even the parks back then were segregated. And he came up as an early playground player, if you can imagine that, for somebody who played in the early 1950s. But he became this player who was capable of playing pretty much four out of the game's five positions on the floor at any given time. He could go down into the post and play center because he was a 6'7" bull who could rebound with anybody in the sport. He had good court speed like a guard or a forward. He handled the ball like a large point guard and was an exceptional passer, almost of the caliber of Bob Cousy when he played in the NBA. And he was he might very well have been the best player in the league for the few years that he was in it. And he played for the Rochester Royals and was with them when they moved to Cincinnati in 1957.
And then the thing is about his illness. It's such a tragic story. And then how he got sick, and they probably shouldn't have had him. He didn't get medical care in time. And then that was very tragic. And then the thing that was inspiring was how his friend on the team who really stepped up to try to help him out organizing charity games and fundraising games for his medical bills, and how he kind of became an inspiring person for the Royals, because guys would visit him. And do you want to talk about that whole saga happened?
Oh, yeah. It's a fantastic story. Probably the biggest story in the history of the team, and probably in pro basketball as a whole. But the whole thing started the very last game of the 1957-58 season, and the playoffs were set, and the team that they were going up to play, the Minneapolis Lakers, had already been eliminated. So it was a fairly meaningless game, and they were just playing it out to fill out the schedule. And during that game, they were, trying very hard to kind of keep Stokes off the boards, and he took a very serious fall and hit his head on the court. And the NBA at this time was a very physical league, and a lot of people at the time weren't really thinking that anything had seriously happened to him, especially this guy who was, 6'7", 235 pounds. He was one of the toughest guys in the league. And he, in fact, went back in the game later and finished it as a leading scorer in the Royals' win. So it really blindsided people what happened to him. But after the playoff game, the first game against the Detroit Pistons in the 58 playoffs, it became obvious after the game that he was seriously ill. And the idea, unfortunately, at the time was just to fly him back to Cincinnati before game two, and if there was still an issue, to get him to a hospital. But while he was in the air with the Royals team and the ownership and the commissioner of the league, by the way, he suffered seizures and became very ill. And after that plane ride, he was permanently hospitalized for the rest of his life.
Yeah, that was really tough. We got a comment here. David from Louisville, Kentucky. Hi, Peter. Hi, Jerry. In your mind, how has the NBA changed since the 1960s?
Well, that's a huge question. It's changed probably in every conceivable way that you can imagine. The 1960s was a two-point era. For most of the decade, there was 8, 10, 12 teams. Motivations were primarily on ticket sales, because there wasn't really any merchandising, and television was really just getting off the ground. And you compare that today, where it's very literally a global multi-billion dollar game. And, there are people in China watching the NBA playoffs, in the United States. It's really a staggering set of differences.
Now, anybody who's interested or knows a little bit about the NBA history, the name Oscar Robertson comes up for sure. And then the thing is, what's interesting is the Cincinnati Royals here, I think of myself as a historian, but you have the Sacramento Kings. This is the Sacramento Kings now. And so you think the sense of the Cincinnati Royals is, at least for me, is very weak, that team, until I started reading your book. But everybody knows about Oscar Robertson, who is one of the greatest players of all time, who played on that team for like 10 years. Do you want to talk about Oscar Robertson?
I do very much. First, I did want to make a mention about Jack Twyman, who I was very lucky to interview for my book. And he was the teammate who stepped up and was the amazing caretaker for Stokes in many respects after he was hospitalized, and really dedicated the rest of his career to him. So I wanted to mention Jack Twyman, who was one of the great jump shooters in the NBA during his time when he played. But as far as Robertson, he was huge to the team. You mentioned the Sacramento Kings. You know, the Royals almost folded in 1959. They were very close to going out of business. And the one thing that kept them afloat, aside from all of the donations that they were getting around the league to keep the team going, was the fact that they had the territorial rights to Robertson. And they were actually selling tickets to see him a year in advance of his first rookie game in 1960, which, by the way, was against the now relocated Los Angeles Lakers at Cincinnati Gardens. That was quite an affair. But Robertson had a tremendous impact on the franchise and is easily one of the greatest players to ever play the game.
Now, your first book was on the Royals. It sounds like you decided after, I don't know, partly because of that project, to write a whole book on Jerry Lucas. You want to talk about Jerry, your book on him and about Jerry Lucas?
Yeah, certainly. The thing about Jerry, and it's almost like a Stokes thing or even a Robertson thing, is he's one of these incredible early figures of the game, if you want to call it that, who had this enormous impact on the sport. And a lot of people have forgotten about him. But Jerry was probably the first nationally known high school player in the United States, even ahead of guys like Wilt Chamberlain and Oscar Robertson. When he became a national star in 1957, he had sort of built on their earlier momentum as national high school stars. And then his impact also at Ohio State was at a time when television was just beginning to enter the college game. Lucas might very well have been the first television star of college basketball. And at that time, the college game was bigger than the NBA. So when he was two-time NCAA Player of the Year, he was actually a bigger name in the game than any of the NBA players of that time. So a lot of people have forgotten about the kind of impact that Lucas actually had in the early 1960s, and I thought that was something well worth writing about.
Yeah, there's a book on the Cleveland Pipers, owned by George Steinbrenner and by Bill Livingston.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't read it yet, but I know he talked about how Steinbrenner was trying to get Lucas for the Pipers, and so obviously there was a lot of competition for his services. And back in the late 80s, the Cleveland Cavaliers had a really good team, and we had, James Donaldson had Lenny Wilkins on his show. We had Craig Eel on this show. And then as I was reading your book, the name Wayne Embry came up. I thought, oh, wow.
Oh, yeah.
I thought, wow, the Cavs GM from during the late 80s when they were doing real well. You want to talk about Wayne Embry, part of that Cincinnati Royals team.
Well, there again, by the way, Wayne is also in the Ohio Basketball Hall of Fame along with Jerry and Oscar, which is a nice story. He was an amazing all-time NBA story himself in that he almost never played, and then the Royals at one point actually cut him. But then they fired the coach and brought Embry back so that he could finally get a fair opportunity with the Royals. And shortly after that, he was an all-star. But he was just an incredible effort player. He was an amazing athlete at 6'8", 250 pounds, to such a degree that the NFL was interested in him as a tight end for the New York Giants in the early 60s. And Wayne, after a very solid pro playing career, ended up becoming the first black general manager in the history of the NBA and went on to have an incredible managerial and executive career in the league, which he detailed in his bio.
We have a comment from Jerry from Sugarland, Texas. He says, John Lucas, such a great man, inspiration and fortitude. I think he's talking about a different Lucas here. John Lucas, who actually was the Cleveland – I got confused about that too. John Lucas, who was the Cleveland Cavaliers coach.
Fine player.
Yeah, tremendous NBA player also. Let's see. Adam from McKeesport, Pennsylvania. How about Jim Jones? This guy was amazing. Any thoughts on him?
Jim is a great story. His recruitment story to Marquette is still one of the most amazing ones that I've ever heard. People talk about hardship athletes and guys that came out of a very challenging urban situations. There's a story where Al McGuire for Marquette actually came to see him, and he was stunned at the condition of the Jones household. These guys were so poor, and there were a number of schools coming after him, but his connection with McGuire, who was a remarkable coach, was such that he ended up playing at Marquette and I think went a long way to making that program in the early 70s. And then he ended up playing for the Cavs, and I'll tell you what, in 1976, if he doesn't break his leg in the Eastern Conference Finals, I think you might very well have seen the Cleveland Cavaliers in the NBA Finals that year instead of the Boston Celtics.
Yeah, that was tough. That was an exciting, yeah, the miracle at Richfield.
yeah.
In your book, when the Royals moved from Rochester to New York to Cincinnati, Ohio, you talked about Cincinnati Mayor Charles Taft, who was the son of William Howard Taft, U.S. president.
That's right.
I thought that was pretty interesting because I was in the Philippines for 20 years, and Taft was the first American governor in the Philippines. So that was pretty interesting. Good.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's see, another player from the Royals who was, I think, the father of two guys, Jim Paxson.
Right.
You want to talk about Jim Paxson?
He played at Dayton, and which is a city in Ohio with a great basketball lineage. And that the Flyers college program is very storied. And he was one of the stars there in the early and mid-1950s. And he played in the NIT for Dayton, which was a perennial NIT college tournament power back then. And he ended up being drafted by the Minneapolis Lakers, the forerunner to the L.A. Lakers. And he was a young guy kind of as a reserve, but when the Royals moved from Rochester to Cincinnati, there was an interest, you know, to include him in the Clyde Lavallette trade so that he could come back to Ohio. And he played in the backcourt in his first and his only year with the Royals.
And he had two sons who played in the NBA?
That's true. Jim Paxson, his son, Junior, is somebody I think a lot of people have forgotten. He was an all-star shooting guard for the Portland Trail Blazers. A lot of people are more familiar with John, who was in the backcourt with Michael Jordan in the mid-90s when the Chicago Bulls were winning world championships.
And which of them played for Cleveland?
Well, actually, it was Jim Junior. Who spent a little time here, yeah.
Right, okay. Now, again, reading through your book, you mentioned Gabe Paul. I thought that was pretty cool because he was, I guess, the Cincinnati Reds GM and later became the Cleveland Indians GM. You talked about Frank Robinson, who I think you said was, of course, was a star for the Cincinnati Reds, and he became good friends with Oscar Robertson. Is that right?
That's true. And, in fact, you know, for a funny little time there, people actually sort of confuse the two of them. A lot of people don't know this, but Frank played at the University of San Francisco and was friends with Bill Russell, who led that program to NCAA championships in the mid-1950s. So Frank was actually a pretty good basketball player, but back then baseball was a more sure bet, and he was a great player for the Reds. And, yeah, the two of them – it was kind of an interesting circle. You had Oscar and Wayne Embry from the Royals, and then you had Frank and Minnie Minoso, I think, was on that team. And then, you know, Bill Russell is on the edge of the whole thing.
Yeah, so it's cool, these Cleveland connections in your book, the things that jump out. And of course, there's a lot of really good NBA history in general, including Elgin Baylor, who played. You want to talk about Elgin Baylor, who played during that era?
Yeah, there again, it's some similarities to Stokes. He came from Washington, D.C. When he came up, it was very segregated. And so he had to work with, you know, the obstacles that young had. And he was actually sort of hesitant to become a college player. And they wanted to send him way out west, which they did with a lot of black players back then. And he ended up in, I think, in Idaho for a year before he ended up at the University of Seattle. And he was a huge star out there. Nobody out there had ever seen a guy like him because, you know, like Robertson, he was a very versatile player. So he ended up, of course, being drafted by the Minneapolis Lakers and went a long way to restoring that franchise.
Now, of course, you talk about Wilt Chamberlain. There's a great photograph where he came to one of the fundraising games for Maurice Stokes, and Stokes was in a wheelchair. Real young Wilt Chamberlain. And you talked about his 100-point game in Hershey, Pennsylvania, of all places. You want to talk about Wilt Chamberlain?
Well, I'm really glad that you brought up the Maurice Stokes game. I have talked about the Royals with a number of people, but it's just sort of a story that gets missed. And it's a big piece of NBA history in that a fundraiser was put together between the Kusher Resort in upstate Monticello, New York, and Jack Twyman, who did so much on behalf of Stokes, and then also the NBA. And what it became, the Stokes game, was like a second All-Star game for charity. And it was an amazing time where players showed up. They paid their own way. They weren't expecting any unusual benefits or services. And the game was played outside. And it was all for the benefit of Stokes, who was sometimes arduously brought up there, you know, to see some of the greatest players who ever played. And one of the real champions of the event was Wilt Chamberlain, who the very first time he played in the event, he was actually a Harlem Globetrotter, and he was in Europe. He was touring in France when he found out that they were going to hold the first charity event for Stokes up in New York. And he flew all the way back across the Atlantic, came to the game in a helicopter, which they landed out there in the grass. And then the young man, who was about 21, 22 years old, went out, played in the game, and he was completely amazing. He's just this incredible 7-foot athlete. And then he gets back in the helicopter after shaking everybody's hands and gets back in the airplane and flies back to France. And he never misses a minute with the Trotters.
Yeah, that was wonderful that he, you know, it was important to him, and he you know, did something really good there to help this poor fella who was, couldn't do, you know, not only was his basketball career over, he just couldn't do anything because he just couldn't, he was paralyzed from this illness. So it's amazing, you know, the NBA history, the people talk about it, but they pretty much talk about, well, you know, it was really the 80s when, you know, there's a lot of focus on, yeah, probably the last 40 years, the 70s. Now, this, you showed a spotlight on, you know, late 50s, 60, in the 60s into the early 70s here, and this, which is wonderful because it just, you know, it's good to know. It's good to know this stuff, and it's really neglected, so it's wonderful that you've written this book. My son was into basketball, and it's funny, during the finals they show these clips from the past, and one of them is Bob Cousy dribbling the ball out at the end of a NBA finals, and he's just dribbling with one one hand going around. And you brought up, you talked about Bob. You want to talk about Bob Cousy from your book?
Well, yeah. Bob is, of course, a legendary figure right up with everybody else that we've discussed. He might have been the biggest player of the 1950s. And what he was a star sort of in the mold of Bob Davies, who had played with the Rochester Royals. But he was this incredibly deft, dribbling ball handler and passer. And he and Red Auerbach literally saved the Boston Celtics from folding in the early 1950s. And that's a part of that team's incredible history. And, of course, the Celtics became this incredible winning machine, partly because of Cousy as well as Bill Russell. And then among the other things that he did after his playing career, he was actually briefly the player coach of the Cincinnati Royals in 1969.
Another guy you brought up, mentioned was Nate Archibald. Do you want to talk about him? He played for the Royals for 1 year, is that right?
He played the last two seasons with the team. The Royals got a good position to draft him in what was then the third round by trading Adrian Smith, a very popular Royal, to the San Francisco Warriors. They're now the Golden State Warriors, playing in the finals. And he was a playground star from the Bronx. He went about 5'11 and 170 pounds after a meal. And he was another one of these kids who ended up going way out west to Texas, El Paso, before Bob Cousy, of all people. He ended up on Bob's radar, and Cousy brought him to the Royals, and he was just an incredible offensive force.
You know, you talked about the dominant Celtics, and it's interesting how you mentioned how they almost folded when you think of them as the NBA, the driving force, and Red Auerbach. And, you know, in my research, the thing I remember, this wouldn't happen now, but Auerbach used to light a cigar when he felt like they were going to definitely win a game. And,
oh, yeah.
And then, and that, from my research, that goes back, he didn't originate that tradition. It went back to Joe Lapchick, who did the same thing earlier, who played for the Cleveland Rosenblums and was part of the,
yeah.
I think a couple titles for the Cleveland Rosenblums in the 1929-1930. So let's see. Now there's a movie about Maurice Stokes called Maury. Have you seen it?
I saw part of it once.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is that when that movie was made in the 70s, there were a lot of technical limitations to the movie now back then. And I'm really glad you brought it up, because I really think it would make a great remake. So what they could really do at that time was a lot of dramatic acting and some limited scene work, you know, to try and carry the script of this guy's story, you know, Stokes and Jack Twyman. And I really think it's a story that would really benefit a lot of people if it could be revisited. And I know the Twyman family is probably still very interested that might be someday a possibility.
Randy from Warren, Ohio, some of the best coaches in Cleveland history here. He lists his: Bill Musselman, Bill Fitch, Lenny Wilkins, Sam Rutigliano, and Terry Francona. We're running out of time here. Our guest has been Mr. Jerry Schultz, the author of two classic NBA books, Cincinnati's Basketball Royalty, a look back at 15 years of Cincinnati Royals NBA basketball, 1957-1972, and Jerry Lucas, Mr. Ohio Basketball, remembering his great basketball years, 1955-1974. That just came out this year.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Jerry Schultz, do you have any final words for our audience tonight?
Well, I'm just glad that there are people out there that are still showing, you know, respect for sports history You know, a lot of people think the game sort of fell out of the sky about 15 years ago or something. And the fact of the matter is it came from places much earlier. And in fact, you know, sports history in the 20th century really followed a great deal of the country. And it's really well worth revisiting and remembering.
Well, that's why I really admire you for taking the time, because you put in the time to do the work and to put together this book on something that, yeah, well, what did I know? I knew for, but it's just cool, all these things that come out. So I'm very grateful to you, and I hope people well, at least it's out there now. That's all a historian can do is do work and put it out there, and it's there for, you know, it's there for forever, and so that's wonderful. So it's been wonderful. So thanks so much for writing those two books, Jerry, and thanks for coming on the show.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
Dear listener, next week we will have James Donaldson, former NBA player and author and advocate for mental health. And after that, we're gonna see about, we'll see who we have in 2 weeks. Dear listener, may the road rise to meet you. May the wind be at your back. May the sun shine warm upon your face and rains fall soft upon your fields. And until we meet again, may God hold you in the palm of his hand. Good night, everybody. Thanks again, Mr. Jerry Schultz.
Good night.
Good night.